Hi, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author. I'm Jim Juno, and this is the show where we talk with authors who write books pertaining to classic movies and Hollywood and entertainment. And my guest today is a man who has written an exhaustive life story on Ian Fleming. The author's name is Nicholas Shakespeare, and the book is Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. This is a, like I said, exhaustive. This is one of the most complete life stories I've ever seen on a person. And you had access to his personal papers, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, I ought to preface this by saying I'm a novelist before I'm a biographer. And 5 years ago, I was on a remote beach in Tasmania at the other end of the world trying to start a new novel when I had a call from London and my agent saying, "We've got a very interesting proposition. The Fleming estate would like to authorize a new biography. This will be the first since 1966, and they would like you to do it." And I confess that my first reaction was slight hesitation. I'd grown up on Bond, like many of my generation, but from sideways glimpses of the author, Ian Fleming, I'd conceived rather a kind of mixed character image, somebody who was rather sardonic, old Etonian, who treated women rather badly, who drank a lot and smoked a lot, a rather kind of unsympathetic figure, if you like. And I suppose one moral of his story, which I only realized a few weeks ago, is don't run off with the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail if you wish to avoid forever after being rented into tabloid fat. Because I think the image I had of him was this very much Daily Mail unpleasant image. And so I asked the estate, flattered though I was, I said, I was going to have to spend 3 or 4 years in the company of this person. And I was kind of minded not to do it, but I said, let me just do some due diligence and see what I think. And in the course of the next 2 months, I discovered two things. One, that he was a much kinder person than I'd hitherto imagined. I mean, again and again, the women who fell in love with him, and there were enough to fill the Albert Hall, said the novelist Rebecca West. Again and again, they looked back on him, even though he moved on and he was a kind of perennial bachelor. He never promised eternal love, but they all wanted to get into bed with him and they fell in love with him. They all looked back on him using the word kindness or kindliness. And that word is not a word I'd associated with James Bond. And it was not only females who looked back on him with this generosity, it was men. I mean, he had a very tight group of friends, mainly from school at Eton, who he kept up with all through his life. These men weren't necessarily very exciting or exceptional, but they were all, without exception, upstanding and upright and decent. And they weren't men who would have been duped by a cad. So I thought that was the first interesting thing, that he was a much kinder person. The second thing I discovered is that he was a much more important person than I'd been led to believe. I mean, a lot of his enemies describe him in the war, the 6 years where he spent in naval intelligence, as just in charge of in trays, out trays, and ashtrays, a kind of chocolate sailor in a smart uniform with no responsibility, in fact, avoiding the action that many of his friends and his brother, one of his brothers was killed at Dunkirk, avoiding the kind of the nitty-gritty of battle. And I found out that was completely the opposite of the truth, and that he'd been absolutely in the inner sanctum of British intelligence. He and his brother, elder brother Peter, were two of only 30 people in April 1940 who were ultra cleared, which meant that they could read the decrypts from the Bletchley Park code breaking machine. And only 30 people in England were allowed to see these, and Fleming was one of them. And, two other writers who I knew reasonably well, Graham Greene and John le Carré, whom themselves worked in British intelligence and made a great song and dance about it in their novels, were very much on the periphery of British intelligence. They were kind of minor functionaries. Graham Greene was in Sierra Leone, and John le Carré was in Hamburg and never had a successful operation, as far as we know. Whereas Fleming, who everybody slightly dismisses, was absolutely in the inner citadel. And he was also responsible for creating various departments in naval intelligence. He created a unit of commandos, which were known as Fleming's commandos, which went into Europe and captured Enigma machines ahead of the advanced troops and sent them back to Bletchley, thereby shortening the war, many people think, by 18 months, and capturing secrets when, after D-Day, coming through Northern Europe, capturing German scientists and secrets and bringing those back to England and America. And talking of America, Fleming was one of two or three people who in April 1941 came over to Washington and New York and helped the Americans set up their own foreign intelligence organization, which is incredible to relate. The Americans did not have, at the beginning of the war, a foreign intelligence organization. And Fleming, with Colonel William Donovan, set up the OSS based really on naval intelligence in Britain. And Fleming did four memos with Donovan, worked on it in Washington with him. And this became the OSS. And in 1947, it became the CIA. So Fleming, when Churchill talked of the special relationship between America and England, he's really talking about an intelligence relationship. And Fleming is one of the two or three people who helped create that relationship. So just to recap, having discovered that he was a much kinder man and a much more important man, I decided I would say yes to this proposal. And I'm very glad I did, because I spent 3 or 4 years not in the company of a cad, but in the company of somebody much more sympathetic and important.
You know, it amazed me when I was reading your book. You know, he had, like you said, he had ties to the world leaders at a time of great change, even up to the time of John F. Kennedy.
Well, Kennedy is a fascinating link with Fleming, and they shared so much. They had I'll describe a dinner that took place in March 1960, when Fleming is visiting Georgetown in Washington to see his friend Otsi Leiter, who was a childhood friend of Kennedy. And in fact, Kennedy and his wife Jackie were living in Otsi's former house in Georgetown. And Fleming's arrived with his new novel that he's written in Jamaica, Thunderball. And it's in his briefcase, and he's meeting Otsi, and she drives him through Georgetown, and suddenly they see Jack and Jackie leave Holy Trinity Church. And they stop the car, and Jack Kennedy leans in through the window, and Otsi says, "Oh, Jack, meet Ian Fleming." And Kennedy says, "Not the Ian Fleming," and says, "What are you doing tonight for dinner? Would you come to dinner?" And Fleming turns up with Otsi, and there are only six people at dinner. And it's an absolutely amazing meeting, because so much takes place, really, that we can see afterwards. Kennedy's obsessed by Fleming. He's read all the Bond novels, and Otsi has fed them to him over the years. And he obviously sees himself as a Bond figure, a kind of individual who can save a nation's fate. But there's more than that. Kennedy and Fleming had both worked in naval intelligence in the war. They were both womanizers. And in fact, in Fleming's notebook, I find the handwritten address and name of a woman that Kennedy was supposed to have married in the late 30s. And his father made sure that all reference to it was scrubbed out. And it's possible they even shared the same lovers. Kennedy grew up, his father was ambassador in London as the war broke out. And the embassy, the American embassy in London, was on the site of Fleming's grandfather's house in Grosvenor Square, where Fleming had grown up. So they had that kind of link. And I think they'd met each other briefly at a party in Blenheim before the war. So when Kennedy at this dinner, and in March 1960, Kennedy's going to be a presidential candidate for the election he wins in November. So Fleming must know that this fan of mine, so to speak, is quite important to my career. And after dinner, Kennedy turns to Fleming and says, they're discussing the vexatious issue of Fidel Castro, whose bearded warriors, the Barbudos, had taken over Havana in 1958, 2 years before. And Kennedy turned to Fleming and said, what would Bond do about Cuba, about Castro? What he's really asking is, what would Fleming do? Because he knew Fleming indeed had set up what became the CIA in a house around the corner from where they're having dinner with Bill Donovan. So Fleming then starts to tell him what he would do, and it completely intoxicated Kennedy. He was bewitched, according to Ötzi Leiter. And what Fleming is saying is that you must render Castro ridiculous. You must flood the air with false pesos that will lead to a run on the currency. You must flash up a cross against the sky from a submarine announcing the second coming and that Castro is dead, because the Cubans are all very religious. And you must shower leaflets from the air saying that the Americans have conducted nuclear experiments in the area, which would result in your beards falling out. And this would be terrible for the Barbudos. I mean, Kennedy just thought this was the kipper's knickers. This is a wonderful advice. And he tries to get hold of Alan Dulles the following morning, saying, who's the head of the CIA? He said, you've got to get hold of Ian. He's got these terrific ideas. We don't know if Dulles did get hold of Ian Fleming. We know that Dulles knew Ian Fleming and was another Bond admirer, as was Bobby Kennedy. And we know that Bobby Kennedy, when he looks at the task force commander for the Bay of Pigs the following April, kind of describes him in James Bond paradigm. He says, oh, you'll know James Bond. And when the Bay of Pigs goes wrong, Bobby Kennedy says, this wouldn't have happened to 007. And so it's almost as if the Bay of Pigs disaster was conceived of as a Bond exercise, and maybe in reaction to some of the stories and suggestions that Fleming had given to Kennedy that night. In fact, I think when the Church Committee report came up, all the papers are kind of hard to find, but or if they haven't been destroyed. But I know that there was one or two suggestions the CIA had to throw a cross in the sky, just as Fleming had described, and to chuck loo paper with Castro's face on it, and also to have Castro was known, like Fleming, to be a scuba diver, loved going and snorkeling. And there were suggestions, which possibly were Fleming inspired, that the CIA should plant exploding shells and should have poisonous goggles, all to do with Castro's love of snorkeling. Anyway, what is interesting is that this was, in a sense, the Bay of Pigs is a ghastly Bond scenario gone wrong. But so it's not only Kennedy who's obsessed with Bond, but it's also the man who kills him, Lee Harvey Oswald. And what I found was an astonishing series of details which come together to describe quite a phenomenon occurrence, which is in November 1963, so leap forward for when Kennedy is president, Kennedy's having arranged for a private viewing of From Russia with Love, the second Bond movie, in the White House projection room. Kennedy can't be there, but many of the people at that private viewing, two or three of them had been at the dinner party in 1960, where Kennedy first met Fleming. Anyway, in From Russia with Love, there's a famous Smirsch assassin, Donovan, possibly amusingly taken from William Donovan. And so Donovan is the kind of Smirsch assassin who's going to assassinate James Bond. Well, Kennedy isn't there that night. He's in Dallas. We all know what happens next. But when the FBI invade Lee Harvey Oswald's rooming quarter, they find four James Bond books. And they find that Lee Harvey Oswald had become obsessed with James Bond, as Kennedy was. to the extent that that summer he'd gone around with a pseudonym calling himself James. So you have the picture of both the president and his assassin being both kind of obsessed by James Bond and also kind of victims of James Bond, because I think a feeling grew amongst many of Fleming's friends that James Bond was a bit of an evil talisman to people who came too close to him. And that's, again, arose when the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, in the middle of the Suez Crisis in 1956, a dreadful post-war calamity for Britain brought on by Eden's invasion of the Suez Canal. Eden escapes in the middle of it to go to Goldeneye, Fleming's, two-bedroom retreat in Jamaica, where he'd written all the Bond books. Eden goes there to recuperate. And in a sense, Eden's kind of demise coincides with Bond's rise. And so Eden's kind of paddling around on Fleming's beach in a dinghy that's leaking as his legacy sinks beneath him. And out of the same waters rises James Bond, the individual, a one-man Suez force who is going to rescue England. And so it's as if the lower the sun sets on the British Empire, the more radiant the glow of Bond, this one-man force. And so Bond has a kind of questionable impact on the lives of real people whose lives he comes up against. And that includes Fleming himself. I mean, right at the end of his life, it's all, people would conceive that he'd almost created this Frankenstein figure who was so successful that he began to devour his own creator. And there's, I think there's some truth in that.
Probably so, yeah, because, you know, and amazingly, when the first James Bond book was published, Casino Royale, well, tell me a little bit about how did he form Bond? I mean, I know that it was named after a bird, after an author of a bird watching book, and but he really input a lot of his own experiences into the character, didn't he? Right, yes. Down to the names of like, you know, light, like you said, light Otzi Leiter became Felix Leiter.
He brings most of his friends into his books. I think it's important to remind ourselves that Bond is almost an afterthought in Fleming's life. He's 43 when he sits down to write the first Bond book, Casino Royale. And he's only got 12 years left of his life. And most of that is spent writing the Bond books every winter in Jamaica, and then editing them and then researching the next one. So his interesting life is over. And I think what he's doing is he's mining the bullion of his World War II experience, his 6 years in British Naval Intelligence, when he's conceiving amazing operations against the Nazis, many of which were put into practice, like Operation Mincemeat, which was the subject of a very good film recently. That was a Fleming idea. And many other ideas either were shelved because they were too dangerous or preposterous, or they were put into action and, you know, haven't really been known about. And I think what happens is that I mentioned earlier that he was a perennial bachelor. He gets the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail pregnant a second time, and she divorces her husband, Esmond Rothermere, to marry Fleming. And he does the decent thing to marry her. But I think it's against his natural grain. I think he was always an independent figure. And he conceives of Bond in the last few weeks of his bachelor life before the marriage, which is to take place in March 1952. And he sits down in February and clatters out on his typewriter, which is a bit like an Enigma machine, if you like, a story that's been brewing in his head of a bachelor intelligence officer in naval intelligence, James Bond. And it seems to me he's trying to retrieve his bachelor life, which he had during the war. He's retrieving the humid atmosphere of the Blitz, where everybody was sleeping with each other. I mean, Fleming was sleeping with his best friend's wives, but everybody was sleeping with each other. I mean, if you felt that the following day you wouldn't be alive, it suspended your normal moral compass point. And so it's important to kind of remember how humid the sexuality of the Blitz was. And so when Fleming is congratulated in the Bond books for looking, being so anticipatory of the swinging 60s, I think really what's happening is he's just reheating the Blitz mentality and putting in a Cold War setting and just, you know, retrieving what he got up to in the Blitz. And yet with a Russian enemy this time, a communist enemy rather than a Nazi enemy. And I think another thing to bear in mind is that towards the end of the war, Fleming contributed to an important paper on the future of British intelligence, the Bland Report. And Fleming himself was chairing Joint Intelligence Committee meetings and Joint Intelligence Bureau meetings. I mean, that's not the act of a chocolate sailor. That is an absolutely central figure in intelligence. And it seems as the war drew to an end in 1945, Fleming was offered the job within intelligence that probably would have led him to becoming the head of British intelligence. And he toyed with the idea of remaining on in intelligence after the war, but then decided to jump ship and become a journalist with a kind of, or if you like, a naval intelligence copycat of 88 foreign correspondents he was in charge of, who many of whom were spooks and spies and in intelligence. And he ran those like a kind of Reuters agency, but also like his naval intelligence unit in the war against the Russians. And I think he conceived of himself as he always loved journalism. He'd worked for Reuters in the 1930s. And I think this was a kind of middle stepping ground. He could go off to Jamaica for 2 months a year and write, which is what he'd always wanted to do. And he kept his links with British intelligence, but they were fairly tenuous. And I don't think, you know, I don't think after the war he really had such an intelligence importance. But what Bond does is to explore what would have happened if he'd remained in British intelligence, the job he was offered. So I feel it's both a kind of retrieval of his bachelor self and an exploration of the kind of life he would have led using many of the operations he'd planned against the Nazis and putting them into practice against the Russians.
How did he feel about his work being translated to the screen? Did he like them? Like Sean Connery as James Bond, because he, in the books, he's supposed to look like the old musician Hoagy Carmichael.
Well, he only saw two of the films,
mm-hmm.
Dr. No and From Russia with Love. He was basically dying as Goldfinger was being filmed. So the only Bond he knew was Sean Connery. And initially, when it's quite interesting that how the films came about, because he'd been trying for 7 or 8 years to get them filmed, his books filmed, because he felt that would kind of release him from having to do a day job. And it's really only when Kennedy chose From Russia with Love in Time magazine in 1961 as one of his favorite books that suddenly that reaches an audience of 13 million. Up until that point, Fleming had only been selling about 4,000 copies of the Bond books in America. And so it's Kennedy's endorsement that attracts the attention of filmmakers. And even so, they couldn't really, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, the two producers who bought the rights, couldn't find an actor who would settle to do more than one film. So they really wanted Cary Grant or James Mason or David Niven. They tried 30 kind of prominent people, but none of them would commit to more than one film. And so they decided to go for an unknown who they could kind of train. And they came across Sean Connery. And I think Fleming's initial reaction was, this wasn't an English gentleman. How would he do the Etonian Bond, the sophistication of Bond? And as soon as he saw the rough cut of Dr. No, I think he was convinced that Connery was absolutely the man for the job. And personally, I think, you know, Connery identified himself with Bond to such a successful degree that he was never really able to escape the success of it. And that's another kind of victim of Bond, if you like, along with Kennedy and Eden and Fleming himself. So I think he was very much a fan of Sean Connery. And indeed, just like John le Carré, when he saw Alec Guinness play Smiley, George Smiley, brought then some aspects of what Guinness had done to the character into subsequent novels. So Fleming brought into the future Bond books, there were only two or three more, but you know, he made Bond Scottish, and he adapted much more of Connery's mannerisms in the last two books of Bond. So that's a nice symbiosis to see how much he appreciated Connery's performance.
Now, they're being, in 2023, it was announced that they were going to republish his works, taking out all the, quote, offensive, unquote, passages. How do you think he would feel about that? Probably know him better than anybody.
Well, he's still a mysterious person to me, but uh-huh. I would hope he'd feel appalled, as I do, and as any novelist does. Who is it to decide what we should take out today? If we start taking it out today, when are we going to stop? I mean, in 10 years' time, are we going to be offended by something different? We're always offended. It seems that literature, to be good, has to face up that it offends people. And you don't have to read the books if you're going to be offended. I think what's offensive is to take it upon ourselves to decide how to have an a la carte attitude to what is acceptable. I mean, no one reads Shakespeare as rewritten by Bowdler, which happened in the 19th century to protect the Victorians from their sensibilities. And I gather now in Florida, they are trying to take Romeo and Juliet out of circulation because it's deemed too sexy. Well, this is to me a nonsense, and I think it's a very dangerous road to go down, and I'm totally against it, and I am sure Fleming would have been against it. I mean, don't read the books if you're going to be offended, but don't alter them.
Well, there is one book you definitely should read, and that is Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. The author's name is Nicholas Shakespeare, and it comes out on April, correct me if I'm wrong, April 9th.
April 11th, I think.
Now, okay. Nicholas, I'm so glad you were able to make it on Lights, Camera, Author today.
Well, thank you very much for listening to me and for having me on.